You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Strictly Business, Variety's weekly podcast featuring conversations with industry leaders about the business of media and entertainment. I'm Cynthia Littleton, co-editor-in-chief of Variety. Today, my guest is David Rubenstein, co-founder and co-chairman of Carlyle Group. Carlyle is one of the world's largest investment firms, with more than $370 billion in assets under management across five continents. The company's reach is vast. Rubenstein helped launch the firm in 1987 after working as a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and for the Carter administration as a domestic policy advisor. He's made piles of money over the years, and Rubenstein was one of the first signers of Warren Buffett's giving pledge, in which the 1% agree to give away at least half of their wealth to charity. Rubenstein's curiosity is as big as his fortune, and he indulges it in nonfiction series that he hosts for PBS and Bloomberg News. His latest PBS offering, Iconic America, Our Symbols and Stories, is an example of Rubenstein's passion for history. He's very concerned that not enough of us know enough about our history to avoid repeating it. With his latest show, Rubenstein visits marquee locations across the country for episodes that delve into what makes a place tick and what makes it uniquely American. His stops include Fenway Park, the Golden Gate Bridge, and the Hollywood sign. But these are not breezy travelogues. The Hollywood episode does a good job of capturing a region that is synonymous with an industry that is very much in the throes of transition. Our conversation takes several turns, including his thoughts on why people generally hate the rich, why his mother deemed him a yenta at a very young age, and he dishes on a bipartisan monthly dinner series that he hosts in Washington, D.C. That's all coming up after the break.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
We're back with David Rubenstein, host of PBS's Iconic America, Our Symbols and Stories. David Rubenstein, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you for having me at your beautiful Madison Avenue offices.
My pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for having me.
David, you're accomplished in many areas, obviously as an investor at the highest heights of investment and private equity. You're an author. You host, by my count, at least three ongoing TV shows, and have numerous specials and things in the works. How does all of this activity in disparate areas come together in your life? Why do you stay so busy?
Well, I'm trying to stay active mentally and physically. I'm now 73 years old, and we all know that when you turn certain ages, your brain slows down a bit, your body atrophies a bit. But if you exercise, or you exercise your brain as well as your body, you can postpone to some extent the normal aging process. I also have a lot of curiosity about things. And when I was growing up, my mother would call me a yenta. Yenta is a Yiddish word for want to know everything. So when people would come to our house, I would always ask a lot of questions. And now I find myself as an interviewer on television or other kind of media, asking a lot of questions, and maybe it came from my intellectual curiosity or what my mother would call being a yenta. So I'm trying to keep my brain active. I'm trying to stay interested in what's going on in the world and maybe stay relevant, because as you get to be a certain age, and you're obviously much younger than me, you get to be a certain age, people look at you differently. So when I turned 70, people said to me at the Kennedy Center, where I've been the chair for a number of years, Mr. Rubenstein, do you want to take the elevator up, or can you walk these three steps? And so, you know, people look at you differently when you hit a certain ages. And so, as you know from covering Hollywood, people don't like to announce their age particularly, and they like to mask it a bit with either plastic surgery or some other kind of cosmetic things. And so I don't have any plastic surgery and don't use any cosmetics, but, you know, obviously I'm trying to do as many things as I can. And I also think, to be very serious, every human wants to give back to society before their time on the face of the earth is over. And how do you give back to society? Well, one way you can do is help your country. And so I do a lot of things that I call patriotic philanthropy. But I think by doing interview shows, I'm trying to educate people and educate myself as well. So I do a lot of different things to keep busy. Maybe that's because I'm afraid if I don't stay busy, something will atrophy, or I won't be as relevant as I would like to be.
A rolling stone gathers no moss.
I've never heard that phrase before. That's you should coin that.
I think somebody might have beat me to it. But you have a new entry coming to PBS soon that is called Iconic America, where you go to different cities and do a really interesting job of looking at how monuments or, you know, iconic landmarks in those cities, what they say about those cities and the economic and cultural and social aspects around those cities. Tell me, what was the spark of inspiration for doing this type of sort of travelogue and history?
For the last 10, 15 years or so, I've spent a fair amount of my time trying to educate people about American history on the theory that we should have an informed citizenry. That was the premise of our representative democracy when it was created. Sadly, Americans don't know much about our country's history. We don't require people to take American history courses in college or high school. We don't even teach civics very much anymore in junior high school or high school. So as part of an effort to do that, I have started some programs, various interview programs and so forth. This particular one was something that I developed with PBS helping, where we would go and take iconic symbols of this country and do an hour show on each, hopefully telling people about the history and the interesting parts about it. So the eight that we've chosen for this part of the series and that will be broadcast on PBS beginning April 26th, the first one is Fenway Park. So with the, after the Fenway Park one, we are going to do the Hollywood Sign, which I believe you've already seen that show.
That one caught my attention.
Right. That one is the famous Hollywood Sign that, as you may know, maybe our listeners don't, it was originally intended to be Hollywood Land. That was the sign. It was designed to sell houses in the Hollywood Hills, and it was the Hollywood Land Company that was selling them, competing with other home builders. Ultimately, that land park got taken down when the homes were all sold, and now it just says Hollywood. So that's another one. Then we have one on the Golden Gate Bridge, one on the American Bald Eagle, one on the Gadsden flag, which says, "Don't tread on me," which has had a long history in our country. Another is Stone Mountain, which is a mountain in Georgia where Confederate symbols are now carved into it. Another one is the Statue of Liberty. Another one is the American Cowboy. And what we try to do is to go through the history of these things, what people might know or might not know, try to do it in an interesting, entertaining format because you want people to watch it. So in many of these, I interview people. Mm-hmm. Many of them, other people do interviews. And we have some really interesting people. The Hollywood one, for example, we gathered a number of Hollywood well-known people for a dinner. And we had talked about Hollywood. And then I went to visit the homes of some famous Hollywood stars and so forth. And I think it's pretty educational and taught me a lot about Hollywood that I didn't know.
You do a good job of, and these aren't just breezy. These aren't just breezy celebratory travelogue episodes. You do a good job in the Hollywood episode of putting, you know, it's a warts and all look at the town. You know, its pros and its cons, and Hollywood just by its, you know, just by that, what that word conjures up has definitely, there's a lot of dark side to a lot of the up and the opportunity. I thought you did a good job of capturing what can go wrong, but also the incredible opportunity. You come to town with a great idea that you can package into a form of pop culture that can be marketed to the masses, and you can be, you know, there are any number of examples. You can be living out of your car and within a short amount of time cashing big royalty checks by dint of a good idea. And that's an intoxicating place. Well, and you captured that very well.
Our country has been premised to some extent on something that was a phrase that was invented in 1936 called the American Dream. Now, the American Dream is kind of a Horatio Alger concept where you start with nothing, typically an immigrant in many ways, and you rise up to success in our country. And the American Dream is something that people generally believe in this country. But a subset of that is the Hollywood Dream, which is you might not be well-educated, you might not be extremely talented in the view of some of your peers. You go to Hollywood and you're discovered as an actor, actress, and something. All of a sudden, you're Marilyn Monroe or something like that. And so that dream still lives on, and many, many people go to Hollywood. It turns out that what Hollywood actually is not what people think. There is no Hollywood in the traditional sense, mm-hmm. where if you go to Hollywood, that part of L.A., that's not where the studios are.
Right.
We try to point out the studios are in Burbank or other parts of the Los Angeles area, but the word Hollywood got to be synonymous with this is where the movies are made. And, of course, if you go to the actual Hollywood, you don't see any studios. You do see Grauman's Chinese Theater, and you do see people's cement fingerprints.
The Walk of Fame and
right.
the, yeah.
But that's about all that's actually related to the movie industry in Hollywood. You also see a lot of, T-shirt shops and things like that in Hollywood.
Times Square-ish type,
right.
Yeah.
If you go to the real Hollywood, which is in the studios in the Valley or so forth, that's where the movies are made, TV shows are made. But the whole culture of Hollywood is one that is, I would say, uniquely American. And what we try to do in these so-called symbols of our country is to talk about things that are really uniquely American. So there's Bollywood in India, but generally, if you think about making movies, you think about Hollywood and a uniquely American kind of enterprise.
And a that meritocracy of sorts. Like you can come, you can be Greta Garbo from Sweden, or you can be Doris Day from a tiny town in, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but Ohio, you know, some, you can be somewhere from the Midwest and come out here and, you know, again, if you get that right mix of luck and idea, you can find your fame and fortune.
Sure. I mean, think of the famous movie stars and the diverse backgrounds they had. So Cary Grant was really Archibald Leach was his real name, and he's from England. Bob Hope, that was not his real name, and he came
Leslie,
from England.
Leslie, yeah, yeah.
And I think his first name was really Leslie, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Leslie, I can't, Leslie, not Leslie Howard, but yeah. But yeah.
No. And you know, people who rose up from very modest circumstances and became famous Hollywood icons.
One thing I wanted to add to your discussion of Hollywood is one of Hollywood as a, the geographical neighborhood of Los Angeles is that one big exception these days is Netflix. Netflix planted its stake. It has actually has offices in Hollywood. And that was a pre-pandemic decision that I think anybody there would say has been very challenging because that neighborhood of Los Angeles is really got a big problem with unhoused. And it's really created a very difficult environment just in and around Netflix. So that there's a lot of the kind of wither Los Angeles seems to be in that neighborhood. Can they make this work with this? They have this incredible sort of anchor tenant that for years they've been saying, we're going to revive Hollywood, the neighborhood. Right. And it's a struggle.
Streaming has changed the entertainment world for sure. And what Netflix has achieved is really been a major factor in changing the way movies are financed, actors are compensated. So if I ask people who's the most prominent person in Hollywood, as I've done from time to time when working on this, then people would often say person like the head of Netflix, Ted Sarandos, who is the co-CEO now.
Mm-hmm.
He's deciding to green light this script or that script. He had a fair amount of money to do it, still does.
Yeah.
And I saw him recently at a Kennedy Center event and, you know, a very nice person. Came there for an event honoring Adam Sandler, who had made some movies, I think, with Netflix. That's why he was there.
Yeah, he's made a bunch of movies for Netflix.
Right. So, you know, you never know who's going to be the most powerful person in Hollywood. I would say today, you know, he's probably one of them. Who are the most powerful people today in Hollywood? I guess they're typically the studio heads or people like the head of Netflix, or there are a couple directors that can make a movie. Steven Spielberg can probably get anything financed he wants to get financed. And I assume James Cameron can as well.
I've never seen such a time in Hollywood where most of the major platforms are in the throes of this massive transition. And frankly, in, you know, various forms of disarray, restructuring, you know, pretty massive layoffs. It is just a part of this, you know, certainly difficult, but it's clearly necessary transition of just a massive reallocation of resources. Can you think, as a student of history and certainly a student of business, can you think of analogous times in American history where we've seen sectors just going through such wholesale transformations in the way they make money? I mean, the way Hollywood makes money on content has changed radically in the last 10, 15 years. Can you think of analogous industries and
times?
Well,
the industry that I've been in, the financial service industry, it used to be you had investment bankers and they would service big corporate clients and big corporations. Over the last 40 years or so, the big clients for many investment banking firms have become private equity firms, which didn't exist 30, 40 years ago, or hedge funds, which didn't really exist in any large scale 30 or 40 years ago. So the people that are often moving Wall Street today are hedge funds, particularly those that are involved in rapid trading kinds of things, or private equity firms of various types, venture funds, growth capital funds, buyout funds. It's really changed Wall Street dramatically, just as you...
Would you say for the better, for the worse? Is
well,
it more
I'll
nuanced?
Well, I'll leave that to historians to figure that out. I'd say it's, you know, as a general rule of thumb, I think when you have changes, it probably historically better than not, but there are always some abuses, some problems and changes. But you think about it, 100 years ago, there were a limited number of big Wall Street firms. And over the years, we still have a limited number of Wall Street firms. The names have changed a bit. Same is true in Hollywood. You had a limited number of studios a few years ago, and you still have a limited number of major studios. So
It's amazing. Those original brand names still really carry a lot of weight.
Yes. If you think about it, the big brand names 50 years ago were MGM, still exists, Paramount still exists, Universal still exists, Disney still exists.
Warner Brothers.
So those big names have stayed around, even though the studios are completely different in the way they are owned and operated than they were years ago. But Hollywood has changed dramatically. The way you get movies finances changed, the way you become a star has changed. But interestingly, it's still the center of entertainment creation. In other words, if you want to make a movie and you want to get a movie financed, you don't typically go to Des Moines, Iowa. You probably go to, you know, Hollywood or Los Angeles, somewhere in Los Angeles. Of course, there's a lot of activity in New York as well. But New York, Los Angeles is still the epicenter, I would say, of the entertainment
Certainly
world.
Certainly in the
and
U.S.
And that hasn't changed in the last 50 years or so. And probably is not going to change anytime soon. I think even with the internet and with all kinds of things that you can do virtually, you're not likely to see entertainment creation activity being done out of the Midwest, let's say. It just doesn't happen. It's not likely to happen, in my view.
The locus of you definitely there's more import export happening. South Korea is a really big exporter of content. Israel is exporting more, both shows and formats for shows that are remade for different audiences. But you can't. And I've seen many times people, you know, companies, even Netflix at the beginning, really, you know, it took them a lot to kind of find their sea legs. But the idea that, well, we can hire people to produce shows, we can pay people to produce shows, there's something having that in-house expertise, having that department, that physical production department that knows how to get people before cameras, knows how to get 10 big trailers out to the field in the Midwest where you're going to shoot that pivotal, you know, the pivotal closing scene in the cornfield or whatever it might be, like that level of expertise, knowing how to deal with tax incentives and all the different literally the payroll in production is a very specialized job because there's so many different unions and so many different rules that you have and contracts. It's a very, very
well, expertise
hard
still,
business to break into.
That expertise still resides principally in the New York area and the Los Angeles area. The only non-U.S., I would say, factor that's changed a bit about how people are entertained in recent years is TikTok. TikTok, which is Chinese-based, of course.
Much in the news these days.
It has lots of controversy associated with it, but it's very rare for an American audience to use a technology to be entertained or to be informed that is not based in the United States. So, mm-hmm. for example, mm-hmm. I doubt if you or I could get through the day without using either a product or a service created by Facebook, Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, or Netflix, all American technologies. Now, think about how you use one or more of those every day. And they didn't exist 50 years ago or so.
Right.
But how many Americans are used to getting their entertainment, their information from let's say a China-based entertainment form? Very, very few. And I think that's produced a fair amount of dislocation and concern in Washington, D.C. for the reasons that have been articulated by government officials. But I think part of it is we're not used to having technology or entertainment or information given to us through a Chinese source. I often wonder why it is that no European technology has taken hold so that Europe, which is a bigger population than the United States, has not created any technology that we are currently using to get through our daily lives. Think about it. I mentioned the companies that you're using, mm-hmm. probably, or their services, but none of those companies are really European-based. China has come up with one so far, TikTok. What happened to Europe? I can explain why probably there's nothing from Europe in this array of companies, but as a general rule of thumb, back to the entertainment area, entertainment more or less for the United States is created in the United States, mm-hmm. essentially, and created more or less in the New York area or the Los Angeles area, with few exceptions. With artificial intelligence, you're now going to have the challenge of figuring out whether you should write your own test essay or have, you know, an artificial intelligence service do it for you, which apparently people are doing. And now there's a big push to figure out whether graders or teachers can have a mechanism to figure out whether something's been written by artificial intelligence or not when they're grading exams. And that's going to be a big industry.
Does that, all of that level of misinformation, does it affect markets? Does it, cause does it mess with people's heads when they're trying to figure things out?
Well, markets move on impulse. They move quickly. There's a general view, get there first with the information and act on it. When the information is wrong and you act on it, that can be a problem. So, yes, people are moving quickly, and sometimes the information is not accurate.
Don't go chasing after any national landmarks. We'll be right back after this short break.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
And we're back with more from David Rubenstein, host of PBS's Iconic America, Our Symbols and Stories. In Hollywood and in other aspects of pop culture, certainly Wall Street, high finance, you know, private equity hedge fund leaders are very often cast as the villain. Do you feel like a punching bag sometimes? Is it hard to square that with the reality that you know?
Well, throughout history, people who have made money, even legally, have not been put on pedestals because generally people think, as Balzac once said, behind every great fortune, there's a crime. And there's a general view by the population as a whole that if you've somebody made a lot of money, they must have done something wrong. And private equity firms didn't do themselves any great favors early on when they didn't pay attention to environmental concerns or diversity concerns or other things. That has changed a bit. But there's no doubt that there's always going to be animosity towards people that make a fair amount of money. People are jealous to some extent, or people think that these people didn't deserve it. If I spend too much time worrying about people not liking what I'm doing, I will never get anything done. And I think it's true of most people. You have to get used to criticism because no matter what area you're in, if you rise up, you'll get critics. People like to take other people down as a general rule of thumb. And so I get used to this after a while. And I basically think I can only do so much. I do what I think is right. People don't like it, then nothing much I can do about it.
You've certainly made a lot, you know, some very a lot of very specific choices with some pretty incredible philanthropy over the years.
Yes, but I get criticized for that too. Let me explain.
Undoubtedly.
There are people, I was an original signer of the Giving Pledge, and there were 40 of us, and you know, I'm committed to giving away not half of my net worth.
Promoted by Warren Buffett.
Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and Melinda Gates. And you're supposed to give away half your net worth upon your death or during your lifetime. And I am committed to giving away all of my money, and I'm working to do that. But I'll give you an example. I went to visit Monticello many years ago. I thought it was run down from what I had thought it would be. And so I said to Monticello, which is Thomas Jefferson's home, he designed it and lived in it, can you fix this up? How much would it take? I'll put up the money. And they did. But I said, as part of this, I think you should tell the good and the bad of Thomas Jefferson. He wrote the Declaration of Independence, but he's also a slave owner who, during his lifetime, owned more than 700 slaves. And he obviously had a long-time relationship with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings. So build out the slave quarter so people can come here. They know the good and the bad. And I think that's important in our history to do that. I've been criticized by some people on the right side of the spectrum saying, well, Rubenstein is so woke, he insisted that Thomas Jefferson's slave background be described. Why should we hear about that when we go tour Monticello? We should just know about the Declaration of Independence. You know, what are you supposed to say to that?
Selectively edit your history.
So I think you'll always be criticized for anything you do in life if it's of any importance. But if you spend your life worrying about people criticizing you, you'll never get anything done. So in the end, I kind of shut out the fact that some people are going to criticize whatever I do, and I just go forward.
Mm-hmm. And you've obviously, you know, you are very much a public figure with your media and television work. Does the work of interviewing and talking to people, let me ask this a different way, does your media work help you in your business and investing life?
It wasn't intended that. It's like I don't play golf. That takes a lot of time. I don't drink alcohol. That takes a lot of time. So I'm not going to bars or anything like that. So the time I would be going to bars or drinking alcohol or, you know, going to wine tastings or playing golf, I have that time available to do other things I'm interested in. And I've taken up interviewing as a bit of a hobby a bit, and I enjoy it. And I like the intellectual challenge of it, the preparation, learning things and so forth. So has it helped me in the business world? I wouldn't say it's hurt. I would say maybe it's helped in this sense. When I go around the world to raise money for Carlyle or other kinds of business ventures I'm involved with, more and more people now identify me as this is the guy on television. So I notice that when I walk into a room, I hear the younger people saying, well, that's the guy from those interview shows. There are surprisingly many younger people who watch my interview shows, and I guess they're rebroadcast on YouTube or other kind of things, they think I'm a full-time interviewer. They don't know that I have a business career and a whole life outside of just doing these interviews. But people come up to me in ways they didn't before and say, can I have a picture with you? And can I you know, talk to you about how to get in the interview business? And I try to say this is a very tiny part of my life. But people now think it's my entire life is just being an interviewer. And it shows you the power of television, power of broadcast, because the interview shows that I do for Bloomberg or PBS tend to go all over the world. And so it has probably not hurt me. People know me better than they did before. Can I cite a specific investor that came in because they liked my interviews? I can't say that, but I can't say it's hurt me in any way that I know yet.
Certainly, though, as you say, the intellectual challenge keeps things firing. David, let me ask you, you are a native of Baltimore. How did you go on the path to becoming a lawyer, to working right in the Carter administration and going into big business?
My parents were both from Baltimore. They married when my father was 20, came back from World War II. My mother was 17, an ungodly young age to get married. I was born
totally unusual for those times.
Not unusual. My mother dropped out of high school to get married. Not unusual in those days. My father never came back to finish high school when he came back from the Marines in World War II. They married. More than 9 months later, I was born. I'm the only child. My father worked in the post office. He didn't have an education, so he worked in a blue-collar job. I didn't have any money growing up, but in the end, it's a big advantage because you know you're going to get somewhere in life. You have to do it on your own. I got scholarships to go to Duke University and University of Chicago Law School, And then I practiced law in New York, and then I wanted to go into politics. That was my ambition, not to make money. I didn't care about money. And I went to work in the White House for President Carter. I'd worked in his campaign in 1976. We won, and so you get to work in the White House. You're in a winning campaign. I did that for 4 years. Ronald Reagan defeated us. I had to go back and practice law. I wasn't very good at it. And then I started in 1987 a private equity firm in Washington that became one of the largest in the world. So it's an unusual story because I didn't have a finance background. I would say that my government career wasn't so successful. I managed to get inflation to 15%, which is higher than what we have now. So nobody's invited me back into government since those days. So that was my basic story. I got lucky. I got lucky and my business career took off, and that enabled me to get involved in philanthropy and then the kind of public broadcasting things I now do. And in this particular case, the show we're talking about is part of my effort to educate Americans about our history. The theory about history is that you don't learn the past, you're condemned to relive it. And the theory of our country is that it's a representative democracy, but it requires an informed citizenry. And we don't have an informed citizenry so much anymore. So as part of what I'm trying to do in philanthropy is to kind of educate Americans more about our history. I have many different programs that do this, and this is one of those programs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of some really good conversations that enlighten complex subjects that can be covered in a 1,000-page book in a more conversational way. I think those are really helpful. I can imagine that those kind of things that would be helpful to classrooms, to high school students, and things like that.
I do have some programs designed just for students, and I do them typically through the New York Historical Society. Let me mention one program that I've started that most people probably don't know about. I thought it'd be a good idea if the people that make our laws knew more about American history. So
couldn't hurt.
So once a month for the last 7 years, I host an interview of a great American historian in front of only members of Congress. And I ask the members of Congress, Democrats, Republicans, House and Senate members, to sit with people from the opposite party in the opposite house so they can get to know them better. And maybe because there's no press there, nobody is preening for the press. Nobody is afraid to be seen sitting next to somebody from the opposite party. It's members of Congress tell me after 7 years, this is one of the most interesting things they're doing to Congress, coming to these dinners, because I just had one a few days ago with John Meacham. I interviewed him about his new Lincoln book. Mm-hmm. And members of Congress are obviously interested in Lincoln. There's no press there, so nobody feels they have to avoid somebody from the opposite party. And so it's
no
a
preening.
Modest. I'm sorry?
No preening.
No preening. So it's an interesting thing we do once a month. And I think it's a modest contribution to kind of bringing Washington together, though obviously a lot more work needed to be done.
Do you get a good turnout?
We typically get 200 to 300 people,
wow,
which is a lot.
That's impressive.
And members of Congress come. That particular one, we had Nancy Pelosi, the former speaker, was there. Chuck Schumer, the current leader in the Democratic side of the House, of the Senate, was there. And we had the Senate and House leaders come typically from time to time, plus committee chairs, and they all like it.
Let me close by asking you something you've probably been asked before. If, given your interest in history and your interviewing skills, what figure from history would you, if you could summon someone back from the past, who would you most like to interview, or who would be in your top three of people to interview?
Well, it's an interesting question because the interview format that we're now engaged in, I kind of think as a form of education, entertainment, started probably in The Tonight Show in the 1950s when Steve Allen was, then before Jack Parr was the host. And then it evolved into daytime interview shows and the whole plethora of interview kind of formats we now have. But we don't have interviews of George Washington. We don't have interviews of Abraham Lincoln because the interview format didn't really exist in that way. So to answer your question, of course, I thought about this. I would love to have interviewed William Shakespeare and say, you know, who really wrote those plays? No one person could have done that. Or King Henry VIII.
Spill the tea.
Why didn't you just get some prenups with your wives and rather than chop off their heads? It wouldn't have been easier. Or Cleopatra, ask her, who was a better lover, Mark Antony or Julius Caesar? But if there was one person I would like to interview, it's to me the greatest American of them all, and that's Abraham Lincoln. He held the country together, wasn't really educated, but he was a brilliant writer. Incredible modesty, humility, and I just wanted to ask him, I'd love to ask him, you know, why he felt it was so important to hold the Union together. Why not just let the South go their way and, and he wouldn't have all the pressures he had. But he would be the one I would want to interview for sure. Probably second would be George Washington for all the obvious reasons. If the people alive today that if I could interview any of them, probably the Pope, but he doesn't tend to do a lot of interviews with people named David Rubenstein. So I suspect I probably won't get that interview.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. We love to hear from listeners. Please go to Variety.com, look for the newsletters tab, and sign up for the free weekly Strictly Business newsletter. Don't forget to tune in next week for another episode of Strictly Business.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.